The Secrets of Doctor Who is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, where we discuss everything about the hit BBC series, Doctor Who. And today we're discussing the first Doctor story, The Daleks' Master Plan. Although we are only discussing the first four episodes this time, and we'll discuss the others in two subsequent episodes. We're splitting it into three. So, but this time we're talking about episodes 1 to 4 of the Daleks' Master Plan. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today on the panel are Father Corey Stika. Hey, Father Corey.
How's it going?
And Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy.
Howdy, Dom.
Folks, remember to like The Secrets of Doctor Who on our Facebook page at facebook.com/secretsofdoctorwho. Retweet us, we're at SQPN, and leave us comments where you find us on social media. We love to hear from you. Another show on the StarQuest Network I'm sure you'll enjoy that you should check out is called The Secrets of Technology, which you can find wherever fine podcasts are found, or at sqpn.com/technology. And we will have more of your great listener feedback at the end of the episode, so stick around for that. All right, so Daleks' Master Plan. Before we get into the recap, just to kind of note, you know, again, we're doing the first four episodes now. Next time, we'll be doing episodes 5, 6, and 8, because we've already discussed episode 7, the very first Christmas special from Doctor Who, the Feast of Stephen. We did that a while back. And then we will do the final 9 to 12 episodes, so just so you know. So, Jimmy, can you give us a recap of what happens in these first four episodes?
This week, the Doctor and new companion Katarina, fresh from the Mythmakers, are very concerned about Stephen, who was poisoned in that adventure. In search of a cure, they land in the year 4000 on the planet Kimbrel, the same planet we saw a few stories ago in Mission to the Unknown, where none of our regular cast appeared and everybody died. On Kimbrel, the Doctor and companions meet the Brigadier, who is pretending to be a space security agent named Brett Vian, the sole survivor of a follow-up mission to find the people from Mission to the Unknown. At first, they don't trust Brett, but he proves his worth by giving Katarina pills that cure Stephen's poisoning. Unfortunately, Kimbrel not only has deadly plants, but deadly Daleks, and they have a master plan to conquer the Earth and the solar system. To this end, they're holding a secret conference of aliens, most of whom are from the outer galaxies, but one member of the conspiracy is the traitorous human guardian of the solar system, Mavic Chen. A key part of the Daleks' master plan is a terrible weapon called the Time Destructor, but it needs a core made of the rare mineral Terranium. Mavic Chen turns over one such core to the Dalek Council, but the Doctor has infiltrated the Council and steals it. Our heroes, including Brett Vian, then take a stolen spaceship to go warn Earth about the Daleks and Mavic Chen, but on the way they're forced to land on a prison planet. When they take off, one prisoner grabs Katarina and uses her as a hostage. He drags her into the airlock, but Katarina pushes the button to open the door to space, resulting in the very first companion death in the history of Doctor Who. Eventually, the rest make it back to Earth, but they don't know who they can trust. Mavic Chen has also made it back, and he tells space security agent Sarah Kingdom to go get the Terranium core back and kill Brett Vian and those who are with him because they're traitors. The audience doesn't know this yet, but Sarah Kingdom is actually Brett Vian's sister, and she's loyal to the order she's been given. When she confronts our heroes and demands the Terranium, Brett won't give it to her. He goes for his gun, but Sarah is quicker and shoots her own brother dead. The end.
Spoilers. Oh, no, I'm kidding.
Yeah. Father Corey, overall impression of this one?
You know, for what is effectively, well, the first third, but introduction of this entire serial, because this really kind of, it's setting the platform of what the whole plan is. It's setting the locations. It's setting, you know, everything that's going on. It really moves pretty quick. I mean, these mm-hmm. four episodes move fairly quickly. There's not a lot of fluff in them. And so that made it quite enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Now we'll talk a little bit about it, but these are lost episodes. There's only three of the episodes are actually available in their full context. And only one of them is from these four. So we makes it a little bit more difficult because you're not able to watch the original content as it was aired, but you still, you know, listening to it, and you know, they do move fairly quickly.
Jimmy, how about you?
Yeah, I think they move quite quickly. I mean, this is really, when you count Mission to the Unknown, this is a 13-part story. Mm-hmm. And normally, I mean, if something gets up to 6 parts, I'm like, okay, this is not going to be super fun. But this does really, this first part of it especially, it really moves. I watched reconstructions for the most part on Daily Motion. You know, there is the one episode 2, I believe, that yep. survives. And I watched that on Daily Motion, and the others were kind of based on a telesnap like procedure, but they also incorporated a little bit of fan animation into them, and they were nicely done. But I like this. This is a good story, and it's going to go weird places in the future.
So,
in addition to having the first companion death, this is also the first appearance of Nicholas Courtney in the series. As yep. I mentioned, he's not yet playing the Brigadier. He's playing this space security agent, Brett Vian. And we're going to have the first returning antagonist, because the meddling monk is going to be back. And that's the first time that an individual antagonist, as opposed to just the Daleks, are back. It's the first time an individual antagonist has come back.
The director, Douglas Camfield, apparently liked Nicholas Courtney so much in this that when he came back to direct The Web of Fear, mm-hmm. he cast him as not yet Brigadier.
Colonel.
Lethbridge Stewart, yes.
Yeah.
It was, good choice. Nicholas Courtney in this was great. I was mm-hmm. actually disappointed to see him die at the end of these. I have not seen these before, so.
He won't be the only one.
Yeah. But I've listened to it on Audible with linking mm-hmm. narration by Stephen
Purvis.
Purvis. And but also watched and sometimes actually synced up the audio from the Audible with the video of episode 2, just because I wanted to hear continue hearing that, because actually the sound was better too. And then, but watch, because I like to see if I can, you know, the direction and the acting on the screen, and the costumes and the, you know, the crazy aliens and that sort of stuff. So that was a fun way to do it. A lot of the fan animation I could find was kind of really bad.
there's one fan animation that's really bad. Yeah. And I didn't watch that one. What I watched was essentially telesnaps, only in this case it wasn't the same guy doing the telesnaps, mm-hmm. but it was essentially telesnaps, but then they would use animation for certain bits of it where they would like add motion, a little bit of motion to the screen. Like if you're on the Dalek spaceship, the Daleks will have a screen in the background and they'll be playing an abstract animation of the Doctor Who opening theme vortex mm-hmm. on that screen,
sure,
just to add a little bit of motion to the screen. Or they'll have something light up, you know, they'll have a blinking light on a panel, right. And it just adds a little motion. And then when you have no characters but Daleks, they'll just animate the Daleks, and that looks fine.
I saw that one.
Yeah.
I saw one of those like that.
Yeah. See, they'll also stitch in clips that have survived, even though they're not whole episodes.
Right. Mm-hmm. See, I did the Audible, but I just watched the second one because mm-hmm. since that was a complete episode, like you said, Dom, the audio quality wasn't as good, but it was still being able to experience it the way it was meant to be experienced. You know, mm-hmm. so that was kind of nice. At least you do get that little break. And I believe, is it episode 5 and episode 10, Jimmy, are the other mm-hmm. ones that are still in
Sounds
existence.
Right. Yeah. Mm.
So each, of the 3 parts of our watching this, we'll at least have one episode you'll be able to actually watch. So,
right.
There's also, speaking of clips that have survived, the clip of Katarina's death has survived, and that's stitched into the version I saw.
I didn't see that. Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, they like loaned it. They had episode 4 and they loaned it to Blue Peter for a 10th anniversary of Doctor Who or something. And of all the things, they wanted to show the first companion death on a children's program.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how that clip ended up surviving. Also, you mentioned the crazy aliens. I really love the crazy aliens that are on the council. They look great. They're all different. I mean, they're all primitive, but they're in makeup technology, but they all look great. I love those aliens.
Yeah, yeah. And they reproduce them in the Mission to the Unknown, so you can see them there in that high quality. So a couple other things just mentioned was this is the longest serial. It's not undisputed. There is some debate over it, but this is to many the longest single story in Doctor Who. Some people say that the Trial of Time Lord, which is 14 episodes, but
that's really four separate stories. Yep.
Yeah, with a linking narration, really, a linking framework. I agree.
Key to Time would fit that as well.
Right, right, exactly. It's an arc, really. That's what that was. But this is a single story, so this would be the longest. Some of it was I had to. It's interesting that they put Mythmakers in between in Mission of the Unknown first. We kind of talked about that when we talked about Mission of the Unknown. So you have to remember, who's Mark Corey? And they come up. They don't. They didn't do back then what we do now, which was previously on Doctor Who. Right. So you have to kind of remember. So we have this mission had been sent with Brett and this other guy who dies really quickly to go look for go to Kembril and look for Mark Corey. So we have that set up that character of Brett right there, right at the beginning, and then we have the Katarina on board the TARDIS with sick Steven, who wasn't this sick when we left him in the Mythmakers, but
he collapsed at the very end.
Yeah, yeah, and he's got apparently blood poisoning or something, which given that's actually pretty true to primitive warfare. Like when you get stabbed and cut with these very dirty weapons, you would get infections.
Lots of bacteria and yuck on there, so it's going to happen.
Yeah, it was not as clean as TV makes it these days. And but it's interesting to see Katarina. She's so technologically far behind.
Oh, man.
That everything has to be explained to her. And I can imagine this might be why they didn't keep her on for very long.
Yeah, so about that, originally this was going to be Vicky's last story. And it was going to be Vicky who went out the airlock.
Oh, wow.
But they decided to have Vicky leave in the previous story and give her a happy ending. So she gets to go off and become Cressida with her lover, Troilus. And so they needed a temporary companion, but they knew. So like when Terry Nation was writing this, he wrote it for at least in the first draft. It's Vicky going out the airlock because she had some disputes behind the scenes with the producers and they wanted to get rid of her. But they gave her a happy ending. Like she complained about dialogue and stuff like that. But they wanted a temporary companion. So they wrote Katarina into episode 4 of the Mythmakers. And she knew the whole time she's just temporary. Because they didn't want a really technologically primitive companion. Now, this, like in this episode, the Doctor, she doesn't know what a key is when the Doctor talks about the key to the TARDIS. And that's ridiculous. They had keys in ancient Greece. She also doesn't know when Brett Vian tells her, get some tablets out of my pouch and give them to Steven. They'll cure his poisoning. She doesn't know what a tablet is. And that's ridiculous, too. They had little medicaments that you could eat in ancient Greece. So, I think this was more of a writer's issue. They didn't know what to do with a character like this than it would. I think a competent person who knew about what an ancient Greek would know. I mean, these are the people who invented philosophy. Okay.
Yeah.
Now that the golden age of Greek philosophy was sometime later than the Trojan War, but still, I wouldn't have a problem writing a character from back then. They could be another Jamie and just roll with anything technological. But she knew that she was only temporary. And in fact, apparently her death scene was one of the first scenes she filmed. And they're deliberately setting it up like at the end of episode 3 here, Katarina, now she thinks she's dead and traveling through the underworld with the Doctor in his magic temple and they're going to the place of perfection, so like mm-hmm. the Elysian Fields or something. But she by the end of episode three, she's telling the doctor, I've got the exact quote, she says, you show me so many strange mysteries. With you, I know I'm safe. And the doctor says, I hope so, my dear. I hope so, which is foreshadowing.
Yeah.
Because that's the end of episode three. At the beginning of episode four, she goes out the space lock.
She also quite a good screamer. when she finds the stowaway prisoner on board. Let's talk about that scene then, because it was interesting to me, you know. He takes her hostage and drags her into the airlock of all places. This prisoner, like the bad idea. And she opens the airlock that sucks them both out, and thus removing this person who was preventing, who's going to make them take the TARDIS mm-hmm. back to Kimbrel.
Yeah.
There was a moment where Steven's like, no, not that button, the other one.
Mm-hmm.
Did she? But then later on they assume she sacrificed herself.
Yeah,
right. Did she sacrifice herself on purpose, or did she hit the wrong button accidentally? What do you think? I think it's ambiguous
because she doesn't even know what a key is. She doesn't know how an airlock works. Right. Now they get her in, once she's drug into the airlock. The doctor is then talking over an intercom to the prisoner that's got her hostage, and he explains enough about how an airlock works that she should have an idea, but she's not going to know which button is which.
Right.
Yeah. They never communicate that information. She just knows one of these buttons opens a door, and so you can read it either way.
Right.
I captured from the transcript, the exact exchange we have after she pushes the exterior door button and they get spaced. Mm-hmm. Steven is horrified and says, she pressed the wrong button, doctor. And the doctor says, she may have wanted to, dear boy. So even the doctor at this moment is mm-hmm. ambiguous on did she deliberately press the exterior button or not. She may have wanted to press the exterior button. And then he says, she wanted to save our lives. So that's his justification for she may have deliberately done it. Brett says
she knew that how to open up the TARDIS door. So it wouldn't be a leap at all to say, okay, well, if I do this switch in the TARDIS, it opens the door. If I do a similar looking switch in this ship, it's going to open the door. Now, whether or not she realized that it opened up the door leading out, of course, even realizing there was anything in outer space. Yeah. Right. You know,
she clearly knew that one of these would open a door.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And she had been told if the exterior door opens, it'll kill us.
Right. They even showed where they took off and the doctor's, oh, I forgot to close the outer door. Oh, and Brett was able to just do it remotely.
Yeah. So. Now, to continue, so she knows that if she presses the wrong button, they'll die. You know, she knows that. She knows pressing a button will open a drawer, but she doesn't know which button to press. That hasn't been communicated to her. So the doctor has said she may have wanted to press the exterior button, and his justification for that is she wanted to save our lives. Brett then says it must have been quick. The doctor says, I hope she's reached her place of perfection. Steven says, yes, but not that way. The doctor says she didn't understand. She couldn't understand. So here we have more ambiguity. She didn't understand. She couldn't understand. She wanted to save our lives and perhaps the lives of all the other living beings in the solar system. I hope she's found her perfection. Oh, how I shall always remember her as one of the daughters of the gods. Yes, as one of the daughters of the gods. So this is pure coping on the doctor's mm-hmm. part. It is not clear whether she deliberately or accidentally killed them. Mm-hmm. And the doctor's just speculating. Maybe she wanted to, maybe she was did it to save us and all the people of the solar system. This is pure copium on the doctor's part. This is really, I was surprised in rewatching this. This is cold on the writer's part of you because they could have eliminated this ambiguity. They could have had her know full well which button she was pressing and did it deliberately, and they didn't.
Yeah. They left it ambiguous. Well, and on top of it, there's another ambiguity, which is she thought they were already dead in a sense, mm-hmm. that they were on their traveling to the underworld. And I know that the Greek conception of what the afterlife is like is a little ambiguous in itself because, well, you know, you could still die in the afterlife.
Well, I was going to say, because, I mean, you read, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and he travels through the underworld, but he's not dead.
Right.
You know, so for her to do that, to be able to travel through the underworld with the doctor, to be like, oh, yeah, well, I've heard stories that you can do this.
Right, right. Yeah.
Incidentally, there are a couple of follow-ups to this story in the expanded media. One of them is a prose piece called Katerina in the Afterlife, and she makes it to the Elysian Fields. And it's like the one of the only pieces of Doctor Who authorized expanded literature that deals with the afterlife. So that's kind of neat. There's also an audio story. Now the character appears, a few times in Big Finish, but there's one audio story that's particularly notable called Daughter of the Gods, where, the TARDIS experiences a time crash with itself in between the Mythmakers and Mission Dalek's master plan, and Katerina ends up in a different future where she doesn't die, and with the second Doctor and, you know, I don't know who, Jamie and whoever, and the Dalek master plan succeeds. And so in a Tasha Yar redemption situation, she goes back and deliberately dies in order to prevent the Daleks' master plan from succeeding. So they repair that ambiguity.
At the time, shortest companion tenure so far, although there will be shorter companion tenures in the future. I mean, I
wrapped up Adam, what's Kylie his name? Minogue
in...
she's a one-off, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's that Adam, the one that got the hole in his head.
Yeah.
The Ninth Doctor, yeah. There are shorter ones in the future, but
this too is only season three. I mean, this is only like the third year of Doctor Who, so this is very early on that they went there.
Right. And we wouldn't have a short tenure, like four-episode companion for a while after this. I mean, this was kind of a, again, Jimmy, as you said, it's because they intended to be Vicky all along, and so they had to vamp a little bit. Although my guess is, spoilers, Sarah Kingdom also bites the dust in this one.
Yep.
That was presumably planned all along. So she
was planned to, they wanted her as a regular companion, but Jean Marsh, the actress, was not interested in taking on a show at this time. And so they ended up killing her in episode 12.
Jean Marsh comes back much later with the Seventh Doctor, which we saw.
Yep. She's three times she's in Doctor Who.
And we've already met her once because she's Joanna in the Crusaders.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, right, right. So this is the third of her appearances that we're seeing.
Second of her.
Third for us, second for us, because we're wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey.
Oh, yeah.
So, Mavic Chen, which actually that the name makes me laugh.
Yeah, I love the name is fine with me, but wow, is this guy weird. I mean,
I have a Mavic right now. It's sitting over here. It's the DJI Mavic drone, which I have to wonder, was someone a Doctor Who fan over at DJI? That's funny.
Maybe. Yeah. He is a weird guy. So he's the guardian of the solar system. So he's like effectively the highest human leader. And he is kind of imperious. He's got that British upper class, slimy, oily villain vibe to him, you know? But he looks weird. Half the time, I'm not sure is he supposed to be human. Because he looks so weird. He's got, and now this is in the year 4000, so this, and it's compensated or compounded by the fact this is in black and white. Mm-hmm. He has this white hair and a really dark skin tone, and it's not clear to me, is that meant to be a human skin tone or not? Because so part of me wants to parse him as an alien, but apparently he's meant to be human, and he also has an epicanthic fold with his eyes. So if that's a human skin tone, which I gather it's meant to be, he presumably has mixed race ancestry,
right,
from either Australia or Africa to account for the skin tone, and East Asia to account for the epicanthic fold and the name Chin. Mm-hmm. He also wears super long pointy fingernails, and he has the weirdest way of writing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
He is right-handed, but instead of grabbing a pencil between his thumb and his first two fingers, what he does is, and you'll be able to see this in the video version, what he does is he grabs the pencil between the fingers of his hand so that he has the middle two fingers. The pencil goes under his first finger, over his middle two fingers, and then under his pinky again. And he has his thumb sticking up in the air, and then he writes like that.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre.
To kind of describe it for listeners, it'd be like if you did the hang 10 sign, but then straightened out the two folded down fingers and then wrapped around kind of what it looks like.
Yeah.
It was kind of odd. It was almost like a calligraphy. I mean, it's not how they do Japanese or Chinese calligraphy, is it? I don't know. It probably has to do with the very long fingernails that they put on the actor. That's probably the only way you could hold the pen.
And he's got kind of a long stylus too for a pencil. It's not the normal sized pencil.
And he has this whole just unctuous, urbane. Mm. Yes, of course. I want massive power, and I'm going to betray the entire human race to get it.
Even though he's the leader of the entire solar system. I want to side note. I love the way that early Doctor Who refers to the solar system. Everybody, the aliens, it is like the only solar system out there. That if you just use solar system, it's the only solar system.
Well, even when they talk about galaxies, we're not necessarily talking about like the Pegasus galaxy or the Andromeda galaxy. It's like other parts of our galaxy sometimes.
Yes. You know?
In the case of the solar system, I can cut them a little slack because the name of our sun is Sol.
Yes.
And so you could say, okay, in the future, this might be the solar system because it has Sol in it, whereas everything else is a star system. And yes, the solar system is a star system, but it's not the solar system because it doesn't have Sol. On the other hand, that's headcanon rationalization, and this is just writers being unfamiliar with astronomical terminology of the day.
It is interesting how science fiction terminology has evolved. I mean, it's very, in the 60s, there was a particular way of talking about these science fiction outer space concepts that really just evolved over time to what we have now. Mm-hmm. Science fiction today doesn't often talk about like space diseases and space guns and guns.
There's a great episode, a great element in this where one of the Daleks is there. So the Daleks are trying to chase the ship that the Doctor and companions have stolen because they got the terrarium. Or terranium or whatever it is.
A little turtle in a jar. That would
My favorite thing along those lines is in The Lost Skeleton of Cadavra, where Dr. Paul Armstrong is in search of that rarest of elements, atmospherium. And some aliens telepathically implant in his wife's mind, Betty, that she must get the atmospherium, but she mishears their telepathic message and she's hypnotized. And it's like, I must get Amish terrarium, Amish terrarium. And her husband is like, Betty, that makes no sense. The Amish don't live under glass. They're free air, I believe. in any event, the Daleks are trying to track and get the spaceship they've stolen because they want the terranium back. And at one point, one of the Daleks says to another, all is ready for their space extinction.
Yeah.
They just shove the word space in front of extinction.
Makes it cooler.
It's like, just throw it randomly in the middle of sentences as an adjective. Why not? So the The Mavic Chen. Yeah. The thing that was interesting to me is as you know, he's the leader of the solar system, but he has no entourage because, you know, whatever, maybe in the,
well, the 4,000s, he did, but they were all on his ship because he did have a crew on his ship.
He had a couple guys that they, yeah, that they basically threw off onto Kemperl and doomed yep. them to death as one of those thorny plants. But it's interesting how, you know, it wasn't enough. He wanted more. He wanted to be a ruler of a galaxy or whatever. You know, it's that sort of that lust for power mm-hmm. that we see, you know, villains in these stories always want. Is they want, it's never enough to be, you know, the most powerful guy in the smaller pond. I got to be the most powerful guy in right. the bigger pond and in the lake, in the sea, in the world. You know, there's always more, more, more. And it's kind of interesting. Well, like, why? Like, well, he's so work.
he's so blinded by it too, that he doesn't even recognize like the Daleks are, they're just using him. All these aliens are. That are at this meeting yeah. don't realize, oh yes, the Daleks are going to let us help rule the universe. Cause of course, the Daleks aren't happy with just a galaxy. They want everything because they're Daleks, and that's what Daleks want.
With friends, well, and, right?
yeah, but they're blinded by the fact that, no, the Daleks are going to use you and throw you away as soon as they have what they want, which is everything. They want everything. They don't even want more power. They want all the power.
Right, don't they do that fairly early to that one alien that the doctor took his robe and dressed up mm-hmm. as him? I mean, they threw that guy under the bus pretty quickly. Zephon, yeah.
Yep. He was blind. He's like, oh yeah, the Daleks need me. I'm not going to come to the meeting right away because they need me, and so they'll wait for me.
Yeah, business tactic of making people wait for you. Didn't work out real well for Zephon. By the way, I really like Zephon's design. Now, we don't see a lot of his body because he's wearing a robe. The entire purpose of which is so the doctor can steal the robe and impersonate him.
Yep.
But basically, he's a plant. You know, you can tell he's like made of seaweed, and you see he's got these seaweed feet and these seaweed hands. And eventually, after the doctor has impersonated him, we see him without his hood up, and he's got this seaweed head. And I like that he's a seaweed plant. That's cool.
Right. Yeah. It's not like Star Trek eventually does with all the bumpy head aliens. They really try to do something different with the aliens in this one. That was good. It was interesting. The Daleks using American style jungle warfare tactics to burn
the forest down. Yeah.
They're using their pyro flame guns. It's a little redundant.
Fire flame. I mean,
they're flame guns.
I got to stop by an ATM machine later.
Right. Yep. Don't forget to put in your PIN number.
Yeah.
When the doctor's talking to Brett, and you know, he basically tells him, you know, look at the Dalek invasion, the last Dalek invasion of Earth back in 2100, and again a callback to that previous story, the Dalek invasion,
where he ditched Sarah or ditched Susan.
Susan, yep. Right? So the Daleks keep coming back to Earth. They just want Earth, don't they? They just want it so bad. It's
been almost 2,000 years.
Yeah, well, there's been a couple of intervening ones as we've seen eventually.
Well, again, and the Daleks, they've decided Earth isn't enough. They want everything now.
Right. But somehow Earth is the linchpin. It's the starting point. It's where everything must begin in order to get everything. It's kind of interesting that they, for whatever
Earth reason. Is the easiest? No.
Yeah. I think. And their plan is called Operation Inferno, and they have this device called the Time Destructor.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they get. But we don't get an explanation for what that is here. I assume we get it eventually.
We will see it in operation.
Okay.
Time gets destructed.
Yeah. But it needs, I guess one of the reasons they need to start with Earth is because it needs the rarest of all elements, Terranium, which is only found in the solar system and is so rare.
On Uranus.
Yes. Yep. And took 50 years to mine the amount they needed. So,
and it's a little, it looks like a coffee cup sized container. I mean, it's not much.
Right.
It's one M, they call it EMM.
Yeah. Yeah, an M of it. It's like the amount that you need for a of uranium for a hydrogen bomb or something. It is not much. So I thought that was interesting. And like I said, it's Chekhov's Terranium, Chekhov's Time Destructor. We'll, like you said, Jimmy, we'll see it in action eventually.
It's what kills Sarah Kingdom.
That's how it kills. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Yep. So when they leave Kembrel to go head back to Earth, they end up crash landing on the prison planet Desperus.
Yeah.
Good name for a prison planet.
Yes. Yeah. They're desperate people there.
By the way, that's probably the most epic TARDIS separation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You literally leave the planet and go to another, go back to Earth.
Right. That TARDIS is way behind now. And I thought it was interesting, like the sort of interlude. It was, if anything, if there was anything in this story that was kind of filler, it was that interlude.
And it's so that they can kill Katarina. That's why they end up going to Desperus.
Yeah, because Dirksen sneaks aboard because he wants them to take him back to Cuba. I mean,
Earth, Kirksen.
Or Kembrel. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is it Kirksen?
Kirksen. Okay. Kirksen, yep.
Okay. I think autocorrect was being
helpful there. Yeah, there were three convicts and two of them got zapped.
Right. Non-fatally, but electric.
Yeah. Shocked, yeah.
Yeah.
So Chen beats them back to Earth, even though they have his very fast ship, the Spar.
The Daleks said they gave him a similar ship, so that's right. How he was able to get back so fast. And he didn't get detained on Desperus for a while.
Right.
And nobody noticed that Chen came back in a odd, different ship.
Well, I think they explain that. So Chen had left saying he's going on vacation. And he has this super advanced ship called a Spar. And the Daleks essentially gave him another Spar. And I guess they don't go into this, but, you know, like, I guess he changed the transponder number on it or something.
Sure. That makes sense. So he claims that Brett is the traitor, and who's not going to believe the president of the soul or the, you know, the guardian of the solar system. And he's got this character, Lizanne. This was the same woman from early on when they were watching a broadcast of, they were trying to decide what to watch and watched a broadcast of Chen leaving.
Yeah, there were two kind of security officials. One of them was Roald, who was not impressed by Mavic Chen and wanted to watch sports. Mm-hmm. And there was Lizanne, who was a woman security lady, an official, who wanted to watch the interview with Chen. So they kind of compromised by watching the news, which would have both presidential interview and sports.
And
it's kind of reminiscent, even though this is way down the line, it's kind of reminiscent of that episode of The Sixth Doctor where I forget if Robert Holmes actually wrote it, but we get Robert Holmes style social commentary by watching the people at home watching television.
Right.
Right. Right. Remember that one? Forget what it's called, but yeah, I remember that one. So
it's the one where Perry gets turned into a bird.
Yes.
Yep.
Yep. So Chen, this moment where Lizanne and Chen, and Chen's giving Lizanne orders to you know, capture Brett. And at one point in the exchange, she says, "Don't you have faith in our computerized data?" You know, as if, like, if something is computerized data, it must be perfect, right? Oh, yeah. I have every faith. And it's like they had a high expectation for how computers would be so flawless in the future. Yeah. And as someone living in a computerized age, it's so interesting.
Garbage in, garbage out.
Kind of like the old joke about it. It's on the internet. It has to be approved to be published, doesn't it?
Right, right. And then, you know, there's this whole thing about they have the chemical makeup of every single one of the 40 billion people in the solar system on file, and there is zero margin for error identification. Zero margin for error. I'm like, wow, that's kind of like that's pretty impressive.
You know, I hate to say it, but that sounds like how people think of DNA as well. You know, DNA testing and everything, that is, it's absolutely 100% flawless. Nothing can go wrong, like somebody fudging the results. I mean, nothing can go wrong.
Yeah.
Or if you, unless you sequence someone's entire, even if you sequence someone's entire genome, twins.
Yeah.
But if in a lot of DNA tests do not sequence a person's entire genome, they just look for certain markers. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they may have a 1 in 1 million chance of being a random match, but in a city with 7 million people, that means you've got 7 matches.
Right. Right. In this entire country, there's 350 people who will match that. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So I just thought that was interesting, again, looking at the perspective of the future from the past. So that's when we get Sarah Kingdom introduced. We kind of mentioned her a little bit already, but yeah, she's straight up slaughters Brett Vion.
He does go for his gun first, though.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. So we're really, it's revealed how, you know, she's ruthless. Yeah. You know, I mean, mm-hmm.
They have a whole conversation about hers where she follows orders. She doesn't question. Yeah. She doesn't ask. She just does.
Mm-hmm. To quote the Bad Batch, a good soldier follows orders. Yep. Yeah.
But as we will learn next time in part 5, she's Brett Vian's sister. Mm-hmm. And once she realizes she's been tricked into killing him by Mavic Chen, she's going to flip on Mavic Chen and become a companion to avenge what happened.
And, I mean, Brett literally just got done killing his friend Drexler, who he decides pretty quickly is a traitor.
Daxtar, yeah, but Daxtar himself was a traitor. It's just that Brett realized it. So lots of killing in 4,000.
I was going to say this has a high body count in these stories.
Well, and especially since part of the opening is the opening speech by Chen is about how it's been 25 years since we signed this peace accords, you know, think of the UN type of setup. Mm-hmm. And we haven't had any war in, you know, since 3975. And now we're going to celebrate the 25th year of that by starting a massive intergalactic war.
Right.
Yeah. This is also kind of reminiscent. So this is like 1966. Mm-hmm. Or so, and it was like, you know, 20 years after World War II, so mm-hmm. that was kind of in, and after the founding of the United Nations, so that's kind of part of the cultural background to how this would have resonated at the time.
That's right.
But yeah, I have in my notes lots of action, especially in part 4, because we get 4 deaths. I mean, mm-hmm. Kirkson and Katarina go out the airlock. Brett kills Daxtar, and then Sarah kills Brett.
Oh, and then 5, because Zephon
also gets executed. Zephon dies too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a lot of mortality in this one episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other notes on this one, Father Corey?
So one thing we need to talk about is there was a connection to the Mission of the Unknown where the Doctor finds the audio recording from Agent Corey and just grabs it and puts it in his pocket. Well, then, as they're flying to Earth from Desperus, they're able to play the audio recording, and we hear just a little snippet of that original recording.
That's he also finds Mark Corey's skeleton.
Yeah, it was right next to his skeleton is where they found the tape. So that's what convinced Brett that this was that there was something going on that they needed to fight against.
Okay. Jimmy, anything else?
Nope.
All right. So next time we'll be discussing episodes 5, 6, and 8. So if you want to get ahead of us on that and go listen to those and find episode, was it 8 online somewhere and watch it. Dailymotion.com is probably a good place you can find that. But I did want to bring up the listener feedback we got. This was on our recent discussion of the 5th Doctor story, Warriors of the Deep. Stotzi writes on YouTube, "Excellent video, gentlemen. I absolutely love this one back in the day. New season, new cricket sweater, new clothes for Tegan, and nope, no new clothes for Turlough, even though he hated the school on Earth he was forced to attend. Never before have I seen such a scathing verbal attack on the human race as I saw the Doctor give in this one. Preston was my favorite supporting character in the story, but man, was she on the harsh receiving end of that outburst. Yes, the writing had some major flaws, the directing too. The Murka was obviously the most embarrassing part. I had read that the fumes from the glue and paint actually made the people inside woozy, for lack of a better term. The strike at the time didn't help. And Davison has always been my favorite Doctor, and this one was a warm welcome back for the Sea Devils and the Silurians, even when the two Sea Devils turn and bump into each other. As bad as the Stormtrooper in the original Star Wars hitting his head on the overhead door. Hilarious." Yep. So I'm glad you enjoyed this. I mean, I enjoyed the campiness of it. There was some funny bits to it, but yeah, I didn't enjoy the story. You know, it was because it was bad that I enjoyed it.
Yeah,
more so than because it was good. But yep. So that's our feedback. And now we'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create the Secrets of Doctor Who, including Roberto B., Vincent F., Don T., Lisa M., and Gerard T. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue the Secrets of Doctor Who and all the shows at StarQuest, and you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. We'd also like to thank Simon Yannick, who edited this episode. So that's it from us. What did you think of the Daleks Master Plan, at least the first four episodes of it? You can let us know by commenting on the show at sqpn.com or the Secrets of Doctor Who Facebook page. Send an email to doctorwho@sqpn.com or visit the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord or leave a comment after you've watched the Secrets of Doctor Who on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/StarQuestMedia. Like I said, we'll be back next time when we'll be discussing the 5th, 6th, and 8th episodes of the Daleks Master Plan. Until then, Jimmy Yakin, thank you for joining me in sharing the Secrets of Doctor Who.
Thank you. I'm ready for my space execution now.
Father Corey Stiga, thank you as well.
Thank you, Dom.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to the Secrets of Doctor Who on StarQuest. And remember, I hope she's found her perfection.